this is part one of two parts. We thought that today would be a good time to sort of introduce introductory topics, give you a little bit of background, and then we'll get into more fact-specific situations in part two. So stay tuned for more information about that. But our title of our presentation today is Working with Justice Impacted Clients, part one. What we want to start with is, who are justice involved clients? Those clients can be in jail, they can be out of jail, they can also be convicted, which means their case, they've taken some sort of responsibility or accepted some sort of settlement in their case, or their cases could be still pending. These individuals can be incarcerated, and that would mean including in a prison, a local jail, even an immigration facility, a juvenile detention facility. So it can involve individuals in different situations, but we'll be touching on all of them today to give you guys a little bit more background information. Next slide. What we're going to be focusing on today is those in the criminal justice system. So those are individuals who might be on probation, parole, be participating in a diversion program. Now, you could, in the course of your work, also come across individuals that are involved in other areas of the justice system. So, for example, if you have a client who's going through a custody dispute, that would be family court. If you have a client who has social workers through DCFS, that would be somebody who's in dependency court, which is the kind of courtroom that I have. You could have a client that is involved in a lawsuit from a car accident. That would be civil court. All of these practice tips will also help you if you're involved in those systems. But today we're going to be primarily focusing on the criminal justice system. This graphic is in your handout, so you can refer to it in case the type print is too small for you, but it's just basically a graphic to walk you through sort of the stages of the criminal justice system. And the first thing that happens is that obviously a crime is committed, and sometimes the arrest is immediate, and the person is then brought to court shortly thereafter. But sometimes there's investigation involved that then leads to an arrest. So we move from the crime being committed to the arrest. And then the police reports or other supporting documents are presented to the district attorney's office, who is in charge of prosecuting crimes on behalf of the state of California. And then the district attorney would decide if the case is going to be filed, and if so, what charges are going to be involved. The person who is accused of the crime is going to also have their own lawyer, and that lawyer typically would be a public defender, which is what I did as an attorney. Or if the person has the financial means to hire a private attorney, it could be a private attorney. And then the case moves into corrections, and that essentially means whatever is going to happen to that case. So if the person might receive some sort of punishment, jail, community service, or some combination therein. The different types of crimes that we're going to be touching on today are misdemeanors, wobblers, and felonies. Misdemeanors are typically low-level crimes. To yourself, you can think of things such as shoplifting, vandalism. Typically, the maximum punishment for those can be either 6 months or up to 1 year, and it does not include state prison. Wobblers are those that are in the middle, and what I mean by that is it's a crime that can be charged either as a misdemeanor or a felony based on the severity of the case or based on the person's prior criminal record. It can be charged either as a misdemeanor or a felony. And then moving into felonies, those are obviously more serious crimes and could involve punishment that includes county jail or state prison. This graphic just goes into a little bit more detail about the difference between misdemeanors and felonies. Again, when we're talking about misdemeanors, we're talking about lower level cases that would involve some form of supervision, just jail, local jail, and no parole. Felonies, however, are more serious, more complicated. They could result in a more serious punishment, which would be state prison. There could also be other forms of supervision, such as parole or PCRS, And so those are some of the differences between misdemeanors and felonies. The difference between prison and jail. So if you've committed a low-level offense, such as a misdemeanor, and the judge has imposed some sort of jail component, that would be a local facility. It's run by a local jurisdiction, and it's typically used as a short-term holding facility. So for example, those who have been arrested but haven't yet seen a judge, or somebody who has a pending case, they're fighting their case and they're waiting to go to trial, or somebody who's serving a shorter sentence. Prisons, however, on the other hand, are state and federal facilities. Sometimes, typically, they're not in large cities. They're located out further away because they need space to be able to construct larger facilities. And they are for those who are serving longer sentences. We included this graphic just to give you an idea of where our local jails are. There are a number that are located in downtown Los Angeles, and that includes our Central Jail, Men's Central Jail, as well as Twin Towers Correctional Facility, which houses our mentally ill individuals that are in the justice system, the LA County Medical Center. So individuals who are incarcerated but suffering from medical issues that need constant medical treatment. And you can see that as number one on the map. Number two is our women's facility down in Linwood. That is a Century Region, a regional detention facility. And then number three shows our cluster of other local jails. It's called by a number of different names, Wayside, NCCF. Essentially, there's a guard gate at the front, and when you pull in, the guard can give you directions to the different facilities that are out there, but they do house males. Our jail population statistics, we thought that might be helpful in this overview. Last year, the average daily population in the county jail was 13,807, so almost 14,000. Notably, a quarter of those individuals are homeless, 2% are veterans, and then particularly relevant for your purposes, that last statistic, 41% are receiving some form of mental health treatment. So that is a pretty striking statistic. And obviously, that might be even underrepresented for those individuals who are not seeking help or are not ready to seek help. So that's a significant portion of our jail population. In the state of California, we have 58 counties. Each of them run and operate a separate judicial system. Here in Los Angeles, we have 38 courthouses, and those courthouses do all kinds of things. They handle trusts and wills, they handle adoptions, they handle, divorces. And so any number of areas, there's a courthouse that does it. Here in the Compton Courthouse, we do almost all of those disciplines under one roof. Another style of court that we wanted to highlight in particular are collaborative courts. Collaborative courts are really great places because it's where people think outside the box to try and solve some of the larger problems that we're seeing. The goal is rehabilitation, reducing recidivism, and improving outcomes. Some examples of those types of courts are things like drug courts, veterans courts, where we try and give unique services and support to try and help people who are going through the justice system. And they can include even youth. So juvenile justice also has some collaborative courts in order to think outside the box and hopefully put people in a better place than when they met the court system. Judge Curlin will talk a little bit about this here in just a moment. Let's talk a little bit about probation and what that means. For felonies, this means that the individual is going to be assigned a one-on-one probation officer. They're going to be supervised by that probation officer anywhere between 2 years and 5 years. That probation officer is essentially going to make sure that that person is obeying all of the terms and conditions that the judge gave them. So if the judge ordered them to do community service, the probation officer is going to be asking that person each month at their monthly visit, how are you doing on your community service? How much have you done? Do you need me to help you find a place to get that community service done? However, if the person does not complete those terms and conditions or somehow violates their probation, that person can be brought back before the judge to receive some form of punishment, which could include jail or a prison sentence. Because again, we're talking about felonies, which are the only type of crimes that could result in a prison sentence. For misdemeanors, we still place people on probation, but it's a little bit different. It's called summary or informal probation. And what that means is that there is not an assigned probation officer, and that person is on probation to the court. So that person can be ordered to come to court with some sort of regularity, but that there's not a probation department that is going to be supervising that person. So for example, if the person has misdemeanor probation for community service, they're not going to get those monthly reminders from the probation officer that they need to get the work done. Instead, they're just going to have a court date wherein they come to court and show the judge how much progress that they've made. Parole can be granted to somebody if the three prongs are met on your slideshow. And essentially, parole means that a person has gone to prison, they've completed a portion of their sentence, and it's been deemed safe for them to then be released on parole, which is a form of supervision that does not include incarceration. So the person is going to be in the community. Sometimes they can go to a halfway house or some sort of treatment program. Other times they're just paroled to an address and they go home. But they do have a parole officer that checks on them, make sure that they're obeying the terms of parole, they're staying out of trouble, and they're hopefully successfully reintegrating back into the community. So we've talked about probation, we've talked about parole, and now we're going to talk about kind of a weird one that's a little bit of a mixture, and that's AB 109 probation. AB 109 probation was created as a way for the state to give responsibility back to local agencies to be able to supervise people. So clients who are going to be put on AB 109 have been convicted of nonviolent, non-serious, and non-sex offender charges, and they are released under AB 109 after they get out of prison rather than parole. AB 109 can include monitoring, such as somebody having to wear an ankle monitor. Okay, so that is kind of a brief overview. We wanted to define a couple terms for you. And now Judge Curlin is going to go into the specifics of the collaborative courts in LA County.
Ashley, before we do that, we do have a question in the chat. Can a person be on parole and yet homeless? And if a person is on parole and becomes homeless, are they in violation of parole?
So yes, both things can be true. You can be on parole and be homeless. I think that's unfortunately fairly common, and something that I think parole officers have to work a little bit harder at. And the reason why is because, no, it's not a violation to just simply be homeless, but you do still have to check in with your parole officer. So if you're staying at a shelter, you need to be able to communicate to your parole officer what shelter you're staying at. If you're staying under an underpass, you're going to want to tell your parole officer where you're staying, because they do like to do check-ins. They like to make sure that you're at where you say you're going to be at and make sure that you're staying out of trouble. So they need to have some way of tracking you down or finding you a phone number if you have a phone number. So yes, you can be on parole and homeless, and no, that is not in and of itself a violation of parole, but you can see how somebody may have difficulty keeping up with their parole officer if they are homeless, and it does create problems for us in court. Trying to make sure that that person isn't violated just for being unhoused. Judge Curlin?
All right. So I'll tell you a little bit about some of the collaborative courts we do have in LA County. I was the judge of the ODR courts, Office of Diversion and Reentry, and there were three programs there. One was for persons who were on probation. They started out as incarcerated, charged with a felony with a severe mental health disorder. Those persons, instead of going to prison, were placed on probation. They were housed. They have a service provider, case manager, individual services. Many of you are FSP providers who have worked with these clients. Then mental health diversion, which we'll talk about in a minute, came into the law. Those persons are not convicted. Their criminal proceedings stop. They get diverted from the mental health system right into the ODR program. Very similar programming to the probation program. The advantage is they're not convicted of a felony and they have the chance to earn a dismissal of the case. For ODR, the persons that we took were the most serious offenders who were schizophrenic, schizoaffective disorder, or bipolar one. So anyone with a mental health disorder can get a mental health diversion anywhere in the county from any court. However, the ODR clients are narrowly limited to those three most serious disorders. The third program that ODR ran was the maternal health court. Those are for women who were charged with a felony, incarcerated, and were pregnant. On any given day, there are about 60 pregnant women in the county jail. That list is given to ODR. They screen the clients and see if they want an opportunity to get into this program as an alternative to incarceration. These women may or may not have a mental health disorder. They live together. They're separate from the other ODR clients. They get services such as parenting, substance use treatment, whatever they need so that if they want to keep the baby, they're in good shape to do so when they deliver. The other courts that we have in LA County, the main ones, we have the co-occurring disorders. Those are for person who have a mental health and a substance use issue. Very, very common. Substance use is very, very common in ODR as well. In the population, we have a sentenced offender drug court. Those are for people who are recidivist drug offenders. This was probably had more power when drugs were felonies. A lot of drug offenses are now misdemeanors, so it's probably lost some of its focus. But I think there's a new judge who'll be taking it over and refreshing that to see what clients they might serve. So they've gone broader into theft cases. So if you are stealing because you have a drug issue, you still might be a candidate for the sentenced offender drug court, even though your charges are theft charges rather than drug charges. Those clients get a 90-day intensive program of treatment in jail, and then they're conditionally released to residential treatment to begin the program. After they complete their residential, they go to an outpatient treatment. There's the Women's Reentry Court, sometimes called Second Chance Women's Reentry. This is a great program. It's attached to Prototypes in Pomona. Women live 6 months in there and then 6 months in the community. A great thing about women's reentry, as with the maternal health court, people can have their children with them of a certain age. So that can be a really successful way to keep women together with their children. We have a veterans court. We're actually affiliated with a representative from the U.S. government, Veterans Services. He comes to court, screens the clients, and sees who meets the criteria for that program. And that is expanding in mental health diversion. There's a lot of legislation pending right now to broaden the scope of veterans diversion. There's the LGBTQ plus court. That's in collaboration with LACADA. Those are for individuals, sometimes called the Rainbow Court as well, who may have a substance use issue. They need housing. They have special issues, and we get them into that program. And then we have a catch-all. That's the Community Collaborative Court. That's for people who may have been in one of the other programs and it didn't work out. It's a vulnerable person. We're not ready to just stop working with them. Or it's someone who may not meet the formal criteria for the other courts, but needs special care and attention. So we try to steer them into a community collaborative court. And the judge really works with the DA and the public defender to find a program that works for the person with regular progress reports. So that's a very individualized program in the community to find services that meet that client's needs. The goal, keep everybody out of jail. There's one more I forgot in delinquency court. Ashley, you might know about the human trafficking court. Can you tell us about the human trafficking court that Judge Arakaki runs?
Yes, there is a special CSEC court, and the goal of that court is to try and get exploited children away from the people that are exploiting them. So they have a lot of really specialized resources and support in that particular courtroom, because we have seen that it's very difficult to separate children from those people who are manipulating them, trafficking them. And so that courtroom has a really intensive approach to trying to help those children. So it's very specialized, very difficult work, but doing really good things.
So just recently, ODR expanded from downtown. There's a hub at the airport, and there was a hub in the valley. It really should be in every courthouse, but it's a matter of staffing, having a psychiatrist, that kind of thing. Wednesday is the intake day, and we actually had the whole team in court with the psychiatrist, the social workers, a specialized probation officer, the substance use treatment. So a very different type of court than a regular criminal court. During the pandemic, I took the Van Nuys hub, because it was small, into my court so we could efficiently work with staff. I imagine that as funding is provided in the coming year, that hub will go back to the valley, and that we will continue to see growth and expansion of the ODR program. All right. So we have these collaborative courts. We also have traditional courts. And it's like, what is the difference? So collaborative courts, it's this sort of, we're all in this together, team approach. Everyone shares information. You're not operating as silos individually. Everyone's looking, what is the best outcome for the client? We may disagree, but we try to see if there's a consensus that we can reach. So a completely different vibe than a traditional criminal court. In a traditional criminal court, everyone has their own role. There's not a lot of sharing of information or discussing what's the best outcome in the case. Each person is really like filling their role. And, you know, you might have judges who aren't comfortable doing collaborative work. I think it takes a special kind of judge. You have to be more conversational. You have to be able to engage the client, speak to the client directly. Not all judges are used to doing that. Judges usually only speak to a lawyer. So you're going to have, if your client's case is in a regular court, it might have a very different approach. And the judge may seem very, very different than a judge who is in a collaborative court typically. So kind of just different skill set. And, you know, like, let me give you an example. In regular courts, when judges order drug treatment, they order 6 months or 1 year. Those are the increments of treatment. Well, that doesn't even match what treatment providers provide. So it's really a big training issue to get out the word that no, it should be 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days of treatment, not 6 months or 1 year. But courts don't know that because it's on our sentencing sheet to check one. And so they check, and then it's this artificially long period of treatment that the person has to go to satisfy the terms and conditions of their probation. So those are the kind of things that we're working on. All right. So how do you know what case your client has? So this is just real quick. Misdemeanors start with a number. It's related to the year. So for example, this year they start with 3. And then if it's a city attorney case, it'll be CJ, 3CJ, which just means like the central judicial district. So 3 is the main letter. And then there's 2 letters that are unique to the courthouse, like DN, Downey, CS, Compton. And so you get to know those after a while, but those letters correspond to a courthouse location. But 2 would be 2022, 3 would be 2023. If it's a felony, they start with a letter and then A. It'll be BAMALAPA, and that is the jurisdiction. So no number starts with a letter. For example, downtown, all of our cases are BA. Compton, TA. San Fernando, PA. Van Nuys, LA. Pasadena, and so on and so forth. So you get to know geographically where those letters correspond. Mental health court cases start with ZM. So they have their whole unique system. Their reports will typically put the criminal case number, but then they give their own ZM case number. And then this AB 109 should really go down to the next that got separated. That goes with your parole violations. Those have these letters PR, PB, or PH in them. That means that they're at Beauchesne, the courthouse that is over near the county jail, and they handle all of that post-conviction violations. So let's talk a little bit about mental health diversion. This came around 2018. It's Penal Code Section 1001.36. This is a wonderful opportunity for people to have their case completely dismissed without suffering all of the negative effects in life of being convicted with a felony. So generally, the defense attorney will identify that their client has a mental health issue. They will get a report from a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist that shows that that person does have a mental health disorder and that the crime was committed. There's a nexus between the crime and the mental health disorder, and that the person could benefit from mental health treatment, and they're unlikely to be a risk if they're treated, a risk to public safety if treated in the community. And then the burden's on the defense attorney to find a program. And that's really hard to do. The advantage of ODR is I had a program, so I could accept tons of people without even looking at the program because I knew what it was. And it was very formulaic. We had excellent mental health providers, FSP programs. And so we had a great program. For other judges, the difficulty is they may be reluctant to grant mental health diversion because they're not sure what the program is or if a program is there, because basically the public defender is trying desperately to piece together things like the client will go see a therapist on their own, they'll go to NA or AA meetings, they'll come to court every 3 months for progress reports, but there's like who's going to write the report and all of that. So it makes it a difficult sell in a regular court, but specialty courts, we know how to do this. We've done hundreds, thousands of them since the law came into being. The diversionary period is up to 1 year for misdemeanors, up to 2 years for felonies. I always give 2 years because I really feel like that gives the most programming benefit to the client. If for some reason, like I've had people who had a job interview, we did dismiss the case early so they could get going with their life. They'd gotten everything they needed to get out of the program, but 2 years would be typical. When the judge grants diversion, the court will order a treatment plan, different terms and conditions. Those may include housing, a curfew, drug treatment, long-acting injections, substance use treatment, stay-away protective order where the person can't go near someone. So it's really important that you know what those terms and conditions are so you can help oversee that the client is in compliance. It could be anger management, it could be parenting, domestic violence classes. Domestic violence classes are always tricky because the client has to do 52 by law. So if there's a delay in getting the person started with a 1 or 2 year period of probation or a 1 or 2 year period of diversion, it's really hard for them to get that done. So you need to know in case you need to get the client into those classes immediately. So typically the person will have that treatment plan and they'll come to court for regular progress reports. And mental health diversion for people who are on medication, they have to maintain their medication compliance as prescribed by the doctor. So the court really needs someone who will write a report and say the person's doing great, they're safe, they're on their meds. We'll talk more about progress reports coming up. All right. There are other diversions that are outside of mental health diversion. So misdemeanor judges often give pretrial diversions. There's diversions in prostitution cases. There's lots of specialty diversions. Those are just other things that might not be a mental health diversion. Then there's a different wrinkle of this. The mental health diversion law allows for people who are legally not competent, legally incompetent to start a diversion. So it used to be we would send a client who was not competent to the mental health court, and they would work on restoration of competency. And we would not see that client until they were deemed restored to competence. And then they would be sent back to us. Criminal proceedings would be reinstated and the case would continue through the criminal justice system. With mental health diversion, the mental health court, rather than sending people to the state hospital and the line, someone can be incarcerated for 8 to 9 to 10 months waiting for a spot in the hospital. And that's not great for people with mental health issues. That's not great at all. So ODR has created programs FIST and MIST, that is misdemeanor, incompetent to stand trial, and felony, incompetent to stand trial, where people get out of jail. They're not going to be waiting for the state hospital spot. They're going to go to local treatment, very similar to ODR, some of even the same service providers, where there's housing, medication, psychiatric care, and therapy for the client. The advantage is at the end of the 2 years or the 1 year, the case can be completely dismissed and the person gets to completely bypass the hospital system. So that's a really, really great way to get these cases managed effectively.
Judge Curlin?
Yes.
Could you explain to folks what it means when somebody's incompetent?
Yes, legally incompetent. Usually the defense attorney is the one who will talk to the client, and you may have things to add to this, Commissioner Price. You realize something's not right. You can't communicate with your client effectively. They don't understand what's going on. They can't effectively contribute in a meaningful way such that the defense attorney can consult with the client in putting on the case. So the lawyer will let the judge know that they have a doubt as to the client's competency, and the judge will suspend criminal proceedings. We send the client to the mental health court. A psychiatrist or forensic psychologist will evaluate the client and see whether they are competent or not competent for the case to go forward. And it's really that able to participate in their defense in a meaningful way. Anything more we should say about that, Commissioner Price, or in your experience as a defense attorney?
I think that's a good summary. Maybe that might be something we go into in part two.
Yes, it is actually in part two, and we will be covering that more. All right, I'm going to turn this one over to Elizabeth Kim. All right, so Ms. Kim, you're up.
We have the question that came up. I think some of you communicate, sometimes you feel maybe unsafe working with a justice-impacted individual. And I think this is actually a really hard one to answer because everyone has their own like personal perspective. I would say that, first of all, safety of you all and of the client is paramount. Your agencies will have policies in place that you should always follow. You'll have supervisors in place that you can consult with. But I would say that in my experience working with these clients, it was really, there are safety issues anytime you do this work, but they're really not necessarily unique to this population. I would say, consider the fact that the clients who are incarcerated oftentimes, and especially the ones you work with, clients who are experiencing homelessness with SMI, clients are poor, with SUD, people of color are often incarcerated at higher rates than they represent in the population. So is incarceration really an indication of safety? Like, can you really say that across the board that someone's been incarcerated, it's a safety issue? Consider the fact also that when you're working with these clients, and I'm focusing really on the diverted clients, like Judge Curlin mentioned in 1001.36 diversion, for example, one of the prongs that has to be met is that the judge and everyone who's a part of that collaborative court has considered whether or not the client can be safely treated in the community. So that's something to also consider. But bottom line is, in my work with these clients, I think the biggest challenges to safety come when you don't effectively support the client, right? If you have a client with SMI who stops taking medications, or where the medications run out and no one's met that, they're going to start to decompensate. And really, like, I think the biggest challenges to safety in working with clients like you guys work with is making sure that we are meeting their needs in terms of medication, face-to-face contact, making sure that we're looping in everyone in court to understand what's going on in the client's case. So, what's really important to do to make sure that happens, to make sure that you read and you understand the client. You're going to get a lot of collateral information. You can read about the client's history. You don't need to know meds. You should understand whether or not they're taking meds. You should be monitoring whether or not they're consistently taking meds, and just really keeping everyone in the loop. And I think there's no real way to say across the board that these things will be a surefire recipe for ensuring everything goes right. But the more you do to make sure that client's adequately supported, the more that you're addressing the issues that I think you're concerned with.
So who's in the courtroom? When you first check in, you're going to go to the bailiff. That's a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. That's just the person who keeps order in the court. They have the people who are out of custody check in with them. So even defendants check in and say, hey, I'm here. And the bailiff says, okay, take a seat. And that way they know who's checked in and who hasn't. And they bring the people who are in the lockup, the custody, into the courtroom and take them back. We have the judicial assistant. We used to call them clerks. Now it's usually judicial assistant, or JA. That's the person behind the desk where lawyers check in, who does all the court files, the computer entries, swears witnesses, all that kind of thing. The court reporter is the person who takes down every word that is said. So that can be really difficult if someone goes off or starts screaming or freaking out in the courtroom, or if someone's really shy or really soft-spoken. That's a really, really hard job. You have the prosecutor, who will usually be a deputy district attorney. If it's a misdemeanor and it's in the city of LA, it might be an LA deputy city attorney. You have a defense attorney, most commonly a public defender, could be an alternate public defender. That's when there's a conflict or there's two defendants on a case. So one gets the public defender and one gets the alternate public defender. It could be the independent defense counsel. If you have three defendant case, one gets the PD, one gets the APD, one gets the independent defense panel. Or if, for example, it's domestic violence and the public defender previously represented the victim, then it has to go to the APD to represent the suspect on a new case so that there's no conflict. So what it just means is there is some defense attorney there from one of these categories. If people have means, they may have private counsel. The PDs, APDs are in the building all day, every day. They are the permanent staff and their offices are on site at the courthouse. IDP and private counsel usually have to run around and make a number of court appearances. So it might take longer to handle their matters if you're waiting for them to come from another location. And then you have a bench officer who will be a judge or a commissioner. All right, who do you check in with upon your arrival? I would suggest you first check in with the bailiff. And if you're with your client, have your client check in with the bailiff. And then secondarily, if you can get to the defense attorney and speak to them, that would be great as well. Or usually they'll come back if they know you're there and check in with you. So you might, if you're apprehensive about coming forward in that little door, we call it the bar there, that little low wall in the courtroom, you might ask the bailiff if you could speak to the defense attorney and they'll kind of get you two connected so that you can go outside and talk more privately about the client. So preparing for your court appearances, what do you want to do? You want to submit your report in a timely fashion so the court has enough time to read and process the information in there. You also want to prepare your client for court. Make sure that he or she knows that they have court, maybe a couple days ahead, and then make sure you're clear on how the client is getting to court. Are you bringing the client? Is the client taking public transportation? Do they know what courthouse, what location? Do they need a ride? All those things, work out all those kinks so that you both arrive safely and on time to court so courts take no adverse action. There are collab courts, you know, like we work with people, we know people are running late or taking public transportation. Traditional courts, if you are not there at 8:30, some judges will come out and issue a warrant for the client's arrest. There's no waiting, there's no dawdling at all. So it's best to be there as close to timing as possible, especially if you're not in a collaborative court. So then again, you're going to check in with the bailiff and the client's attorney. All right. So should you come to court? Yes. If you know that there is a court date, it is so helpful, I think, to have the service provider, case manager, FSP representative there to give information to the court, answer any questions. However, during the pandemic for my court, we switched to non-appearances for people who were doing great. Because of COVID, we couldn't have 75 people in my courtroom in the morning, all sitting squeezed in. So we pivoted and made what are called non-appearances. So this was my court policy. Different judges will have different policies. For non-appearances, I just needed the report. If the person was doing great, I just continued the case to what I thought was the next appropriate interval. And often the service provider would suggest 2-month date or a 3-month date for the next progress report. If it's an appearance, those were for people who were struggling and I needed to talk to them to take corrective action, or they could be on WebEx if they needed a little bit of a talking to, but weren't at in danger of being remanded. So it depends. So you kind of got to, you know, I don't want you to drive all the way to court. There's no good parking. It's expensive. You walk 5 blocks only to find out it's a non-appearance. So that's why it's really good to know what type of appearance it is before you come, but definitely appear if you can. You're going to do your checking in. Ideally, you're going to speak to the defense attorney in a more private setting than before the case has called. So what do you do if something has changed since the report was written? Really good idea to share that information with the court if you're asked to give an update or a verbal. I always like to put the representative's name on the record and hear from that person directly. Other judges may or may not do that. For example, if you wrote a glowing report and your client is in court and they are high or delusional or something is not quite right, you need to let someone know right away. So very important to either bring an updated report if you have time to write and print that, or notify someone that there's a change of circumstances. So that's the kind of thing. If your client's not stable, they've gone off their meds, they're responding to external stimuli. We've had people get punched on the way to court. So like something unusual, or jump out of the car and run, you know, something weird, the court needs to know so the court can take appropriate corrective action. Because as we've said, it's really, really important that you, public safety is the primary consideration in the criminal court system. So you should be prepared to speak in court. So don't be shy. I usually ask people, state your name, spell it for the reporter. What information do you have to share with the court? And some judges will want you to come forward. Some you could just stand in the audience, but you want to make sure the court reporter can hear you and adequately get down what you say. So you want to be concise and thorough in your comments. All right. Sometimes we put people in the program and then they won't sign releases of information. This is a big no-no. So clients have to agree to sign all the releases so the court can get updated reports, the attorney, probation, everybody can find out what's going on, what's happening. Is the person on their meds? Have they tried to change their meds, et cetera? So very, very important that if you're doing intake, you make sure that you get all the waivers and releases signed that your agency requires so that you can appropriately share information with the court parties as necessary. All right, we talked a little bit about this. You want your client to be dressed on time, ready to go to court. I cannot tell you how many clients disappear the court morning and aren't there ready for pickup. They get nervous or something. Sometimes it's a great report, so I don't know why that happens. It's pretty common. People just get nervous, so just try to reassure them, make sure they're ready to go and get to court on time. The client should speak to the attorney before the case is called. So ideally, the defense attorney will know the client is there, will go out in the hallway, speak to the client privately, also speak to the client with you. So those two things usually happen where they speak with you and without you to the client. As we said, the judge may or may not speak to the client directly. Depends on the comfort level of the judge. Some will only want to get information from the attorney and will have a more formal environment to their courthouses. So court appearances are a really great way to let the judge know if there's any issues, concerns, problems. If we've put an onerous, like we've ordered someone to do something and they're just not capable of it, like community labor, good time to let the court know so they can delete that requirement. We don't want to put too much on someone and then they fail because they're unable to satisfy all the terms and conditions. So it's just kind of a good sharing of information, touch base. I love progress reports because those are the people I get to know really, really well because I see them regularly in court. All right, let's go to the next slide. Here's some words that you might need to know that come up. Probation violations. That's when someone violates probation. It could be internal, something mundane. They just quit reporting to probation or they're dodging their probation officer. So not super serious, but they're not regularly reporting as they're ordered to do, which is usually monthly. Or it could be more serious. The person is incarcerated and charged with a new crime. So they've been arrested. They actually have a new case pending. Both of those things are probation violations. And we determine what is the appropriate course of action. So if there's a new case, we see if that could come into the diversion or ODR or specialty court program. Or we have to assess whether that case now makes the person ineligible to continue in the home court, in which case the probation violation follows the new case and those go to whatever court, and it may mean the person will no longer be in a collaborative court. Reinstatement is when the judge says, you know, you failed to report, it's not such a big deal. I'm going to have you admit a violation. I'm going to reinstate you. So that basically means probation starts over again and now they have to, they get another chance and have to report to probation, the court may modify the terms of probation. So for example, if drug conditions weren't part of the original probationary grant, but now the person is struggling, getting high, bringing drugs to housing, got arrested for a pipe, the court may now add narcotic conditions and random testing conditions. So the probationary terms may change. It's good if you would know what those changes are. So let's talk about remands. Remands can really freak people out. That's when the judge decides for public safety, the person needs to be taken into custody in the courtroom and they will be booked. They will be taken to the jail and they will have a timeout in custody. So that's basically a remand. We're going to come back to that in a minute. We have bench warrants. The person has failed to show up. The court has two options. They can issue a warrant for the person's arrest and revoke probation or diversion because they have failed to appear in court, or they could do a hold. And a hold is, we might find the person in a week or two. They do come back even though they leave. So let's give them a chance to not go into custody and show up in court. And I very frequently will ask the representative in court, hey, what do you think is most appropriate for your client, a bench warrant or a bench warrant hold? So if it's someone that always comes back and they just weren't there that morning and you want a chance to locate them, let the court know a bench warrant hold would be appropriate for that client. If it's someone who's off their meds, they've been disappearing for a month at a time, a bench warrant is probably the course of action. And you know why that is? We don't want something to happen to the client. We don't want them to overdose. We don't want them to get arrested and pick up a new case while they're out running around. We want to make sure we safely and securely get them back in custody, restabilized, and assess whether they can get another chance at the program. So that was one of my big learning curve issues at the beginning. I was trying to work with a lot of people and not put them in custody when there were violations. And I saw so many people getting new cases that I realized I was doing them no favor. So sometimes it just takes that time out, admit a violation, get them back into the program.
Wait, Judge Curlin, how about clearing a bench warrant?
Oh, clearing a bench warrant. Yes. If it's a hold, the judge has set a date the person needs to be in court. And so the person can come in on that date and clear the warrant. You can walk them in ahead of time, but a bench warrant hold does not actually issue. So the person's not in danger of being arrested. For a bench warrant, the person is in danger of being arrested at any time if they're stopped by law enforcement. So you would, if the person comes back, probably contact the court or the defense attorney, get the case on calendar for the client to be walked in right away, for the warrant to be recalled and quashed, so that the person can be reassessed for getting back into the program. All right, medication. A lot of times people agree to something and then they try to negotiate their way out of it. So in ODR, our psychiatrists were very big on a long acting injection. Obvious advantages, one shot every month makes it so much better than making sure people are taking daily medications. So if the doctor ordered long acting injections, I would actually make that a condition of probation. Then sometimes people go see the psychiatrist and try to get their medication changed. It's really important that you know what the court's order is, because if the court has ordered long acting injections and the client wants to switch to oral medications, that change could be a violation of the terms of their probation. So how do you manage that? It's really important that the psychiatrist be aware of what the judge ordered and they do a medically appropriate assessment of what is the appropriate medication. Taking meds is non-negotiable. If meds are ordered, that is, the person has to take their medication. And some people are like, oh, you force people to take meds? I'm like, absolutely not. This is an alternative to incarceration. If you want to be in the program, you take all the terms and conditions that come with it. If you don't want to, that's fine. Your case will get resolved in an appropriate way for probation, jail, or prison outside of our collaborative court system. And you do not have to take your meds. But if you want to be in the program, you do have to take your meds. And my expectation is 100%, not 20%, not 50%. 86 isn't bad, but really I want to see 100% medication compliance. But it's also good to know, like, sometimes the person is getting their injection, but the report says they're not medication compliant if they're not taking Benadryl at night or something like that. So it's always good to specify that they are on the long acting injection, so the judge doesn't come down too hard on somebody that's really getting the primary medication that they need through the injection. I always tell people, if you are having side effects, you absolutely have an opportunity to discuss those with your doctor. So if there's a legitimate issue to switch the medication, or we don't want people to be sick and not able to program, if they're over medicated, they're under medicated, always there's an opportunity to meet and confer with the psychiatrist. And I always encourage the case manager or service provider to go as well, so there's clarity as to what was said and what was prescribed going forward. So you have to understand that the court is expecting medication compliance. And especially if it's not a collaborative court, they're going to be very nervous about people going off their medication. All right. Substance use. Honesty is always the best policy. Experienced judges know you don't go to treatment once and you're cured forever. That this is a process. People will do well. They'll relapse, do well, and relapse. Sometimes people need a timeout in custody to keep them alive. We've had so many deaths from fentanyl. It's alarming and frightening. And sometimes I have seen people be remanded on a violation. I can send them to the in-custody substance use treatment program, give them a chance to get out of the cycle of whatever they're doing so that we can give them another opportunity in the program. And MAT is always an option. There are so many options medically right now, and experienced courts will permit someone to participate in MAT to help them. Okay, so you just, that honesty and is the best policy has got to be an overriding concern for you. And this is different because you're used to maybe working with the client and your loyalty is to the client. And in a collaborative court, there's that tension between making sure the court has accurate information while also showing that you're loyal to your client, you've got their back, and that you're speaking out for them. So we talked about remands a little bit. Those can be really stressful for everyone. But the goal is usually restabilize the client and give them a chance in the program. It doesn't necessarily mean the program is done with them, but it might. It just always depends on the facts of the situation, what's been going on, how many violations the person has had, where we are at, but it's that public safety is the primary consideration. If drugs have been brought to housing, I need to know that. If the person repeatedly has had a pipe at housing, I need to know that. If the client is not going to their classes, or they are going, but they're continuing to get high, I need to know that. If they leave residential treatment and they are AWOL, I need to know that. So, you know, a lot of times people go to treatment and then they're still struggling. It's okay to let the court know that. Sometimes people have to go back to residential. Sometimes they can stick with intensive outpatient and we could see if that's working. But it's just really important that we have accurate information about substance use, because we don't want anyone to overdose. It's horrible. Like, there have been people, I saw them in court last week and the next week they're dead. And it's just shocking.
What we wanted to do today is give everyone sort of a background and explain some terms. And then next time we're going to be giving some hypotheticals, letting you guys ask questions and talking about some of the questions that, for example, what do you do about substance abuse? There was a question that we briefly addressed. What do you do if your client is in court and actively having delusions, or you think your client's in court actively high? How do you handle that? So Elizabeth Kim will be with us next time to lead most of that conversation, but Judge Curlin and I will also chime in. We'll give you guys some hypotheticals. Judge Curlin, if it's okay with you, we'll save the rest of your slides with the practice tips and we can talk about those in part two so that it's a bit more interactive next time.
Absolutely.
One caveat. I just want to make sure anything we said, for a client, their attorney should really be their primary contact. That question you just raised is a really good one, I think.
Yeah. If you go marching into court on a non-court day, the judge is not going to know what to do with you, unless it's a collaborative court judge. A regular judge will be like, who is this person? What is happening? So, you will really call the lawyer or maybe even a probation officer, but that lawyer will be your starting point.
Thank you so much. The next session will be on June 7th, and we'll continue this wonderful training and discussion.
Thank you, everyone. See you in a couple weeks.